there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 408. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, the handle is thisshowissogay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have two incredible guests for you this week. Let's start with the first one. Kirsten Palladino is an award-winning editor and writer. She's the co-founder and editorial director of equallywed.com, the world's leading digital LGBTQ wedding magazine. She also blogs about trauma recovery at foragedwellness.com. Kirsten has been profiled on CNN and in the New York Times. Her work has appeared in Entrepreneur, Art News Magazine, Art and Antiques, The Knot, Executive Traveler, The Huffington Post, and so many more. She was recognized as one of Glamour Magazine's Hometown Heroes for 2015. Her debut book, those words are so exciting, is called Equally Wed, The Ultimate Guide to Planning Your LGBTQ Plus Wedding. She is now here with us. She is back here with us. Kirsten, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you for that wildly wonderful introduction. I'm blushing over here for sharing all that information, and thank you so much for having me on.
It is your fourth time on this show. I'm hesitating to say this to you, but we have to highlight it's been almost 4 years since you were last on the show.
That's incredible. Well, it's not like we haven't been talking
exactly
off the radio. Wow, I'm so exciting. Maybe on the fifth time I'll get a jacket like people do on SNL.
Wow. We will certainly send you a magnet.
Thank you.
No problem. Now, do you know the year of your first appearance on This Show Is So Gay?
I want to say it was in 2012.
2010. Seven
wow,
years ago.
Okay. Wow. And that's when we launched Equally Wed.
See, look
you
at that.
You had me on the first year.
Look at that.
You.
We were only 17 at the time, you and I.
Oh, yeah, I know. Such a good time.
Well, we have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
I am. Let's dive in.
Well, let's start in the unlikely event, I would hope, that people do not know equallywed.com, especially because we haven't talked mm-hmm. about it in 4 years. Tell everybody about equallywed.com.
Sure. So equallywed.com is an online magazine with a global audience with a focus on the U.S. We cover real weddings, information about marriage equality news, wedding equality news, and as well as inspiration from getting your outfits to deciding what flowers or plants to use to working with, avoiding homophobic vendors and dealing with homophobia and transphobia in the family to, you know, writing your own vows. So many different things. We cover it all on equallywed.com.
I would hope at this point the number of homophobic vendors has gone down.
It has decreased, but it is nowhere near where we want it. We have so much education to do. It's incredible. For every one awesome vendor that I meet, I talk to five who, you know, there's a range. There's straight up homophobe, doesn't want anything to do with gay people. And then there are the people who their heart's in the right place, but they make the weirdest, most awful comments and ask, you know, those uncomfortable questions like, who's going to be wearing the pants? And they laugh and then nobody else is laughing with them and it's uncomfortable. Or, you know, you're checking in to your hotel where you're going to have your reception and you're so excited and you're right there with your spouse-to-be and you have planned to have a king bed, and then they're at the front desk insisting that you must want two queens. That just couldn't be that you two are going to be in the same room and want to have a king. And it's your own wedding. So there are so many challenges along the way in planning your wedding when you're an LGBTQ couple, which is, you know, why we wanted to provide this resource.
On the one hand, you and I are both change makers, but I don't know that I really want to be doing the change making education as I'm getting married. You know, like I want to change the florist, but at the same time, I also just really want the flowers.
Exactly. I know. And it's unfair, you know, and I think all marginalized people, they have a lot to put up with. And it's up to our allies to get on board and help us through this to make true change.
Yeah. And also we should highlight not just the hotels, but there are certain countries that are not maybe the most friendly for us to go to.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. I mean, you know, Jamaica, St. Lucia, those places can put you in jail for holding your partner's hand on the street.
Yeah.
It's all right. Pretty. They're pretty things, but they don't do pretty things, you know, with gay people. It's pretty ugly, in fact. And, you know, Belize, up until very recently, had a law on its books that it was illegal for homosexuals to enter their country.
Wow.
Now, they just changed that, but that didn't really make me want to go and spend, you know, $5,000 on a honeymoon there.
No. What about honeymooning in Atlanta?
Well, we definitely have a lot of things to do here in Atlanta. I wouldn't call it the most romantic city. We have wonderful restaurants. There are a lot of things to do. I suppose because I live in it, that I don't think of it as a honeymoon destination, but I'm sure plenty of people could find it romantic for themselves.
And listeners, if you're wondering what that was the sound of Kirsten Paladino being fired from the Atlanta Tourism Board. What happened there? We got to work on that. Well, before we even get to the book, and I'm so excited to talk to the book, we actually had a couple of our listeners wrote in some questions for you. Ready for some questions?
Oh, my goodness. Sure.
Okay. Anything exciting, new and exciting happening creatively with rings these days? What do we know about rings?
Oh, so yeah, there's so many different ways to be creative with rings. I love how far along men's wedding rings have come without looking super cheesy. Black onyx stone paired with diamonds, inset of, you know, a variety of different metals. I'm seeing a great number of engagement rings for men, which is incredible, with, you know, larger solitaire diamonds, but still having a masculine look to it. And then people are also really getting into wooden rings. And then also there are different types of rubber rings that are great for, you know, for more sporty people that actually either it can be something that you wear in place of your wedding ring, but then some people are straight up going straight for those, the rubber rings and not having any metal at all.
Yeah, I saw a couple they posted on Facebook just yesterday with their wooden rings.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right.
They're beautiful.
Let me ask you one more question, and one of our listeners wrote this in, and I will tell you, I feel there is a right answer to this, so we might disagree on this. I'm just telling you
no
in advance.
Pressure.
Okay, no pressure, no pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay, and I have such a definitive answer to this, I laughed when someone wrote this in. Is it okay if you are invited to a wedding, okay, to bring as your plus one someone who the couple knows but clearly wasn't invited?
Oh, I think that's super tacky.
Yes!
Super tacky. And how uncomfortable.
For everyone!
Yes, I wouldn't want to be the plus one who was brought to a wedding where I was clearly not invited.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I think that if the plus one even knows the couple, it's weird.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Great question, because I'm sure that has come up in real life.
All right. That makes me feel so much better. And someone also invited me as a plus one a few weeks ago. And I'm like, no, I know these people. They didn't invite me. Again, listeners, we are here with Kirsten Paladino, award-winning editor and writer, who apparently sat down one day and said, you know what? I need a book. I'm calling my book Equally Wed, The Ultimate Guide to Planning Your LGBTQ Plus Wedding. At what point, Kirsten, did you say, I got to do this book?
Well, I have been thinking about it for several years, and I also was thinking about a way to reach more couples who may or may not have heard of Equally Wed. When LGBTQ couples go to the bookstores, they're going to be faced with a lot of heteronormative wedding books, and it's not necessarily that those writers and the publishers wanted to exclude us, but they're doing so all the same. And and it's hard to figure out where we fit in. Even the books, there are just a couple of books that have been written over the last two decades for same-sex weddings, but they don't include transgender people. They don't include non-binary people. They don't include queer people. And their language is exclusive as well in terms of, you know, just because it might be two women getting married, it's not necessarily two brides. My wife hated the term bride. She didn't want to identify as that. And I know many other butch women who don't use that term. And so I wanted to provide a wedding book for all couples who basically don't want to subscribe to, or they either subscribe to society's descriptions of gender or they don't. But either way, they're going to find something in this book that they identify with.
Nice. Nice. Let's talk about process. Did you have a certain place in the house you sat to put this together? Now, mm-hmm. because I know that there are little human beings running around in your house.
It's true. I have twin 6-year-old boys.
I cannot believe they are 6 years old already.
I know. It's incredible. Time just doesn't slow down.
Wow.
They're wonderful. I have to, first of all, thank my wife for making it easy for me to get away on weekends, and then if there were family trips, I stayed behind and wrote while she was up in the mountains hiking with them. So I really, you know, I dedicated the book to her, my wife, because it's even though, you know, as a book author yourself, there may be just one name on the front, but it takes many people to support you to get it done.
So exciting. You totally stole my thunder, which was your thunder. I was going to read these 12 important words: my heart, my joy, my cheerleader, my comfort, my rock, my forever.
Mm.
Even though it's the phone, you're blushing on that one, right?
I am. I'm totally blushing. Yeah, no, I am married to just an amazing person who makes my life easier.
Nice. Nice. Well, let's go through some of the contents of the book. I wish we could cover everything, but we want people to go get the book. Everyone needs to go right now and pick up this book, Equally Wed, The Ultimate Guide to Planning Your LGBTQ+ Wedding. Let's talk about the reception. We don't talk about the reception all that much. What are some key points we need to be thinking about with the reception?
Sure. Planning your wedding reception. Most LGBTQ couples tend to have their reception in the same area or same venue that they have their ceremony, which can be quite different than straight people who may get married in a place of faith and then have their reception somewhere else afterwards. What I like to tell couples to do is when you're planning your reception, think of it visually as people are walking from one section to the next. And how are you going to make them feel welcome in each corner of that space?
Nice.
You know, where you have opportunities to make them feel welcome in the bathrooms, at the tables, at, you know, whether it's food stations or at their assigned seating, at the cake table, you know, how the noise level in the cocktail hour, you know, is it really boisterous and a lot of, you know, words in a song, or is it soft jazz so that you guys can talk to each other before the big party starts? There are just a lot of different ways to make your guests feel comfortable that I explore in the book that will inevitably make the wedding more enjoyable for you.
Nice.
Happy guest, happy couple.
How do we go about choosing the music?
You know, I think that working with a DJ or a band, and really going over your interest, but then also making some leeway for things that other people might like that aren't necessarily your cup of tea, brick house, things like that people like to hear at weddings, just to get them out on the dance floor, even if all you like are like coffee house, you know, guitar things, it's numbers. It's good to consider what else will allow your guests to have a good time as well.
Nice. You know, it strikes me that maybe a key piece of this whole thing, and you have a whole section on it, making it legal. That's important.
Absolutely. So even though we have federal marriage equality now, yay, the book is not exclusively just for U.S. readers. There are plenty of areas in the world where we don't have marriage equality, Australia being one of them, and where we do have readers. And then also in terms of having legal protections beyond marriage, even though you may be legally married to your spouse, if you travel to, say, a red state and somebody gets hurt or sick and needs to go to the hospital, just saying that you're married is not going to be good enough in some rural areas. And you have to carry that paperwork with you, not just your marriage, but my advice is to sit down with a lawyer and go ahead and get the advanced health care directive that says that this is my legal spouse and my legal spouse has the right to come in the room with me in the hospital, take my body home should I die, all of the things that straight people just don't have to worry about.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty darn important. You know, Kirsten, I would like to believe in my world, I no longer believe this, but I would have liked to have believed, I think I used to, that if you write something good and put it out there to the world, then everyone will just find it. But apparently it doesn't work like that. Talk to me about,
it's hard.
Talk to me about promotion because, you know, I think that's the maybe sometimes unglamorous part about this, but we always have listeners who write in and say, God, I want to get my work out there. And this is an important piece of the process.
It really is. You know, part of it is that ugly word platform.
Yeah.
And it's, it really is important, you know, to already have your own audience. As you and I know, it's great. You already have listeners. We already have readers who, you know, are eager to find our next thing, our next product. And if you don't have a platform, it can be incredibly difficult. And one of the things that I've done for getting the word out about this book is pitching it to different media outlets that I can write about. You know, certain aspects of LGBTQ weddings, what are the differences between LGBTQ weddings and straight weddings, or, you know, what's it really like to plan a wedding as, you know, as a queer person, things like that, that, you know, that I'm already an established expert on those topics, and why wouldn't they want me to write a little bit about it? And that's not necessarily promoting the book. I just usually get to throw that idea in there that somewhere in there or in my bio that I have the book out. And so that helps a little bit. Yeah, you're right. There are millions of books for people to choose from. How are they going to find yours specifically? It's a challenge. And as you know, we're wading through those challenges every day.
Yeah. Talk to me about that moment. I know you recall it when you held it in your hands for the first time.
I didn't believe it. I really was just like, this is surreal. Is this my book? Is that my name on it? You know, when you're working with the art team on the cover and things like that, that's really exciting when you first get that JPEG in your email. And this is our cover mock-up. And then the next, you know, this is our final cover. All very exciting. But then when it's actually in your hands, it's quite unbelievable.
I am not someone who has ever said something like, you know, I like certain colors. I love the color of your book.
Oh, thank you. I do too.
That's a pretty blue.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it makes me happy.
Nice.
It's a happy blue.
What is coming up for you? I would imagine you are just all over the place talking about this incredible book.
Yeah, I do. I have some really fun book talks on the horizon. In August, I'll be in Boston on August 3rd at the Harvard Bookstore.
Yes, nice.
Doing a Q&A. August 3rd at 7 or 7:30 p.m. And then in September, Labor Day weekend, I'll be presenting author at the Decatur Book Festival, Decatur, Georgia. And it's actually the country's largest book festival. So I'm excited to be involved with that. And then some smaller talks around, especially the East Coast, my neck of the woods, and then getting in front of a variety of different wedding industry professionals and teaching them how to be more quality-minded and giving them my book to look over and see how they can better work with our community.
Our books have only been out for a few weeks, but I feel like you've already had a great interaction with someone about your book. Tell our listeners about one interaction that you're like, yes, that's why I did this.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, at my book launch party, I was so excited that had actual strangers come to the party.
Nice.
Because they wanted to buy the book. And that was really exciting to me to, you know, of course, I loved having friends and family and industry folks there. But to meet people who were planning a wedding and really wanted to feel less alone in their community and to feel like they had somebody kind of holding their hand through the process and talking to them about you know, our specific needs, and it was exciting, you know, that they were looking to me for answers, and that just felt. I was very humbled by it and honored to be a part of something so special for them.
I love it. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. Stroll on over to equallywed.com. There are so many great features on there. I want to have a rock and roll wedding. That looks amazing.
You can do it.
You can do it. A pale pink Florida golf club wedding. You know, Kirsten, I actually just heard about a friend of mine, my closest friend. She's a pastry chef, so she does a lot of wedding cakes. And she told me about a couple who they just didn't want to deal with all of the pomp and circumstance of the wedding. So they invited their whole family to a cabin, family and friends, for what the family and friends thought they were celebrating a 30th birthday party. And they surprised their family and friends with a wedding.
I love that. I love that. Yes, that would be so much fun. I wish they'd sent me an invitation.
There you go. Me too. Equallywed.com. And of course, go on over to wherever fine books are sold, right there online, Amazon, wherever you need to go, pick up Equally Wed, the ultimate guide to planning your LGBTQ+ wedding. It is visually stunning. It has so much incredible information in it, but your book would be nothing, Kirsten, without the colossal amount of heart that comes through on every page. This isn't just a how-to book. This is a book about our whole community, and it's really a beautiful thing to behold.
Thank you, Ken. That means so much to me. I really appreciate you saying that.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really love you and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel, my love. Spring is here, the sky is blue. Whoa, birds all sing, yes, if they knew. Today's the day, we'll say.
All right, folks, and we are back with another incredible guest on this week's episode. One of the most fantastic shows out there on Broadway right this very second is the Tony-nominated War Paint, and one of the reasons it is so incredible is due to the show's powerhouse music and lyrics, and here this week, I bring to you the ridiculously award-winning lyricist of that show, Michael Corey. Together with Scott Frankel, Michael has worked on some of the most amazing shows out there, including Doll, Grey Gardens, Finding Neverland, Meet Mr. Future, Happiness, Far From Heaven, and dozens more in the future that I think we haven't even heard about yet. But first, let's stay in the present and say, Michael, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
So glad to be here.
We have so much ground to cover, Michael. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
When little Michael Corey was running around, was being a lyricist always the dream?
Oh, no. I wanted to be a composer.
Oh.
There was no one to fill in the words. So eventually I started filling them in myself. And then I found that I enjoyed that more than writing down all those little black notes on the paper. And it freed me up to write other things like opera librettos.
Yes.
I don't know if anyone starts out to be a lyricist.
What were some of the first lyrics that you wrote where you said, oh, wait a second, I'm pretty good at this?
Well, I remember the first lyric I wrote. It was called Gerbils in Love. And I don't know, it probably convinced me not to be a lyricist for the next 15 years. Then the next one should have convinced me not to be a lyricist. I thought that I wanted to be a pop lyricist because I didn't know really that you could be a theater lyricist.
Yeah.
And I wrote a terrible song called You Are My Instrument of Love.
Wow.
And then they very kindly said to me, I think you're in the wrong workshop. You should go find a theater workshop. Oh, okay. So I found Lehman Engel and the BMI Musical Theater Workshop, and I've been writing musical theater and opera ever since.
But why have we not recorded?
I've never done as You Are My Instrument of Love. That's a doozy. Maybe I'll have to save that for you.
Well, you mentioned, and we'll get to your partnership with Scott Frankel in a second, but you've worked on so many other projects. I have to tell you, one of the most interesting to me is writing an opera about Harvey Milk. Tell our listeners about that experience.
Well, slightly before I wrote You Are My Instrument of Love, I was a harpsichord major of all things at Brandeis University.
Yes.
And I decided that the harpsichord was a ridiculous pursuit, and I would have to be playing early music my whole life. So I came to New York to be a journalist, and I got a job at the Village Voice opening the mail and made friends with all these fantastic people. This was maybe in the early years after Stonewall. And people at the Village Voice, if you remember where Stonewall occurred, the Voice office used to be on Sheridan Square.
Yes.
Overlooking the scene of the Stonewall Bar and the street below. And they loved the fact that they had been there. And it was their photographer, Fred McDara, who got locked into the bar with the drag, or who locked the policeman into the bar with the drag queens. He got all the photos that exist from Stonewall. And so I met all these people, and they used to refer, this is probably a first, nobody knows about this.
Yay.
They used to refer to the Stonewall Rebellion as our little riot.
Wow.
And they were so proud of it. And, you know, they covered it extensively every year, and they helped the fact that within 5 years they were, you know, gay liberation groups and support groups springing up all over the country. So I was 19 years opening the mail, and I started writing articles about this. And I found out about Harvey Milk, who was doing great things in San Francisco. Then, you know, a number of years later, when I decided I wanted to write an opera about Harvey Milk, I was drawn to the news. I've always been drawn to, maybe it's something to do with the world we live in today, but living figures or recently dead figures become mythologized almost right away, maybe thanks to television or the internet, and audiences are interested in hearing about things that really happened.
Yeah.
And I'm always interested in a way of breaking news because of my early journalistic background. So when I wrote Harvey Milk, I actually went out, and a lot of the survivors who worked with him in the milk train, they called it, were still alive then. His lover, Scott Smith, I stayed with him for a while, and he opened up what they called the Harvey Milk Archives. At that time, before they gave it all to the library, it was a file cabinet stuffed with stuff. And I, you know, asked him questions, but what was it like when Harvey decided to run for office? And he mentioned a haircut. So I said, oh, I could write an aria about a haircut. And usually that's how I get inspired to write a whole piece, by some facet in the middle of it that gives me some kernel of truth. That happened with Grey Gardens also, when Scott Frankel said, what if we made a musical of documentary Great Gardens, I watched it again, and I had a scene where old Edith was cooking corn in a crock pot next to her bed. And I said, if I could write about a song about this corn that kind of explained her situation, her relationship with her daughter, then this could be a musical for me. So that was the point of entry in that, and the haircut was the point of entry in Harvey Milk. And I've always been attracted to real people, so it happened once again with War Paint.
Yeah.
Which are the real figures, Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden, who basically developed the whole field of cosmetics as we know it today, and were arch rivals.
So before we're going to dive more into War Paint, right. You mentioned Scott Frankel. Talk to me about meeting Scott for the first time. Where did that happen?
Well, there's a phrase in Yiddish, it's called making a shidduch.
Yes.
Which means a match. Gold of the matchmaker would make a shidduch. So some music theater festival in Philadelphia was doing a piece called Sitting on the Edge of Tomorrow. And they were going to get a lot of the new writers to take a look at the 1939 World's Fair. The concept was, wouldn't it be great if the future looked at the past? That went nowhere. But what happened was that a shidduch was made with Scott Frankel and me, my lyrics, because by that time I wasn't interested in writing music anymore, and Scott's music. And a conductor named Michael Barrett, who was a protege of Leonard Bernstein and this wonderful conductor, paired us up. And we found that we clicked.
What is the process like for the two of you? I don't work well with others sometimes, Michael, and you guys are so prolific. Do you work separately? Do you sit in the same room? Is it different for every show?
People are very curious about that, how
yeah.
it works. I'm not sure why they're so curious, but maybe everybody is secretly writing a musical in their head. I tell you, I am used, when I was in The Voice, and then I later edited my own newspaper, you sit in the newsroom, and what's a good headline for this, you call that. And whoever has the best, that's the headline. And you say, done. And you don't agonize over it. Or would you please edit my lead? So I got used to collaborating, and the whole concept of whatever the best idea is, that's the one we go with. And I think that's the essence of collaborating. It's, you have to be a little bit selfless. You can't be neurotic and protective. You can on certain things you can go to bat for. But basically, in a collaboration that involves a composer, a lyricist, in a musical, a book writer, a director, performers, why should anyone be unhappy with what they have to say or what they have to listen to when they sit there and watch it, when there's usually another way of saying it?
Yeah.
So I was of that mind, and when I wasn't of that mind, they reminded me to be of that mind. And we work in all ways. Sometimes it's lyrics first, sometimes it's music first, and sometimes it's both. Lyricists do have to learn how to be flexible in this regard. When you're in previews for a show or an opera, and somebody says, you know, this makes no sense. We need this lyric changed to get from this scene to that scene. We have to set this up. We have to establish a point here that's not happening. Well, you can't rewrite the song. You can't rewrite all the orchestrations at great expense. And it has to fit the notes that are already orchestrated. So you have to be able to write to the music. You have to have that skill set. But you also have to be able to find a title for the song, which we call it a hook in music. And basically, it's because it's a title, but it's also a hook that gets into the ear of the listener so that a song can kind of have signposts. A lyricist should be able to come up with a hook that encapsulates a scene in music and also makes the bridge from talking, which what the book writer is doing, kind of match that tone and take it into the world of the composer. So the lyricist is kind of the bridge. And just as an example, there's a moment in this show, War Paint, where Elizabeth Arden finds out that she's going to lose control of her company. And they say, oh, but we're going to keep your signature pink, the color pink. And that strikes a bittersweet chord with her. She says, is that all my life amounted to, a color? And she looked at her life through the prism of this color pink. Well, nobody knew what to do for that moment. All we knew was that the other character on the show, Helena, who is played by Patti LuPone, had a fantastic song about her art, and that we had to have an equally fantastic song for Christine Ebersole playing Arden. And no one knew what to do, so I said, leave it to me. And just went around and went into my dream state and came up with this idea of pink. And I wrote this whole massive lyric. And Scott set the whole thing. We played it for Christine Ebersole, who's the actress who plays it, and brilliantly. And she said, oh, that's wonderful. Can you write me a new one? Which is not an unknown situation. She likes the idea, but she didn't feel the music suited her voice. She wanted something else. So Scott said, oh, we really like this song. Let's rewrite the A sections. And that's what you'd call a verse that leads up to a chorus. So he wrote music that didn't fit my lyrics at all. And I rewrote the lyrics to the music and had to come up with a whole new way of saying the same thing. And that was good. But then we said, let's rewrite the chorus also. Same thing. And then we rewrote the very long bridge, which is what comes between choruses. So basically, we wrote that song twice in two different ways. Once to music first, once to lyric first. And within both of those processes, there was a lot of horse trading back and forth. Can I have another syllable here? Can I lose this pickup note here? And that's how you work it out, so that everybody gets to say what they need to say.
Nice.
Does that explain?
That explains it. I love it. I don't know that I can duplicate that, but I love hearing about it. Again, listeners, we are here with Michael Corey, award-winning lyricist, also behind the Broadway musical Out There right this very second, War Paint. Michael, you're appearing right this second on this show Is So Gay. You are part of a team, an out gay creative team. Do you think that being out in this industry affects the content that you put out there in the world?
I think, yes, it certainly colors my perspective on things. Right now, there are some other shows running that are about real people. But I'm very imbued with what they call the gay sensibility, or used to call it,
yeah.
And so are my collaborators. I'm just drawn to bigger-than-life subjects. And it doesn't just have to be a woman of a certain age. It could be Harvey Milk. It could be a lot of things, but something has to strike a chord to justify the act of singing. Singing is not what we do. We don't walk around singing. So how can you ever say that real people walk around singing? I just don't believe it. Certain characters you do believe will sing because it's kind of the ultimate expression of what they're thinking or feeling, and it has to rise to a crescendo and take you on a journey. So I'm drawn to these larger-than-life characters, and I guess a lot of gay people are too. So I share that with them, this sensibility. As far as it being affecting the writing today, you know, I think the gay sensibility has totally affected our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And gays can't claim that we have a monopoly on it anymore. There's a lot of gay sensibility in a lot of different films, movies, TV shows that are not necessarily gay in subject matter, but there's a certain approach. I mean, look at the films of Tim Burton.
Right.
That's not gay, but they have a sensibility. And I think that, you know, it worked that way in the political movement, the way the civil rights movement influenced the women's movement, which influenced the gay movement. What we learn influences the entire culture and filters down. One thing I'm finding odd, though, is that I feel I did in my younger years. I've always had gay characters in all of my shows, and when it was a big deal. When I wrote Harvey Milk, it premiered at the Houston Grand Opera in Texas, and we actually got death threats. It was a very conservative state, and Reagan, I think, was president, and the opera said, well, first of all, they hired security for me and the composer, which was appreciated.
Yeah.
And, Harvey Milk himself had a premonition that he was going to be assassinated.
Right.
And it didn't take so much imagination for some nutcase out there to say, in this story of assassination, let's go assassinate someone. So the opera hired security for us and kept it very hush-hush. They also said, do you want to wear bulletproof vests? And I thought about it, but I had had my tuxedo all measured out, and I'm not going to ruin the line. I guess that's a gay sensibility,
right,
in clothes. But, so I didn't get shot. But then it was a very, very big deal. And it was probably the first contemporary gay opera in an opera house. I mean, I can't really think of any before then, except maybe Death in Venice. So I feel I did my bit for gay heroes, gay role models. You know, we had strong women and Cronenberg and the whole San Francisco community. And I really feel I did my bit for role models. And lately I've been drawn to maybe people you wouldn't consider gay role models. They're gay, but they live in a time when it's very, very difficult to be gay. In Grey Gardens, there was such a character who was an alcoholic. In War Paint, there's such a character, Harry Fleming, who begins working for Helena Rubinstein and then sells her out and goes to work for Arden. And I like characters when they don't do completely admirable things, but you have to sort of put yourself in their shoes. It gives you an understanding of what it was like to be gay in a different era when you really couldn't mention it. But I don't always feel the audience is with me on that. I sometimes get complaints. Why do you do a negative portrayal of this man or this woman? We need role models. Well, you know what? You've got role models. We've got role models all over the place. And yes, gay youth needs role models. But in my musical or an opera, you're not going to get a role model. You'll get a role model that says how you shouldn't behave.
Right.
Well, War Paint is on Broadway right this second. Everybody needs to go see it. What is coming up for you, sir, that you're excited about?
Well, I'm very excited about a new musical that I'm doing with James Lapine, who wrote Into the Woods and Sunday in the Park with George, and Tom Kitt, the composer of Next to Normal. And it's about the use of LSD in the 1950s, when actually LSD was legal and was used as a tool for psychiatric exploration. You could get it if your psychiatrist prescribed it. And it was sort of before all the whole psychedelic thing of the 60s. And there are some very interesting characters who got together and took it. And I said to my collaborators, you know, I'm very interested in this subject, but I actually am not much of a druggie myself. I never took this. Do I need to? But the more I explored it, I realized I can just go there without the drug. I just go into my dream state, which is where I always go to figure out what these characters are like. I walk around, I pace around, I find myself in a different room than where I started, coffee cups littered all around the house, but I have a lyric. So maybe I'll still try LSD, but right now I'm just finishing the show.
That sounds like a plan. Listeners, this is what we need you to go do. You can learn more about War Paint, the musical, by going to warpaintmusical.com. In just a few weeks, Ghostlight Records will be releasing the original Broadway cast recording of War Paint, so you can pick that up anywhere fine music is sold. Michael Corey has been nominated for Tony Awards, Drama Desk Awards. He received the Outer Critics Circle Award. He's also been been the recipient of the Jonathan Larson Award, the ASCAP Richard Rogers Award, and the Mark Blitzstein Award given by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Michael, you are putting words out there that we are singing along to, that are affecting our experiences of seeing the theater, that are giving us a soundtrack for what we see before us, and it's a beautiful thing. We're all looking forward to some show in the future where the 11 o'clock number is You Are the Instrument of My Love. I'm excited for it.
That will be exciting if that ever happens.
Michael Corey, please keep doing what you're doing. It is just incredible work that you are putting out there in the world.
Well, thanks. This has been fun, and thank you for saying all that. And listeners, War Paint is a fun show. Go, enjoy.
Every woman is a natural beauty, but the right face cream can work miracles.
Does my eyeshadow go with my clothes? Are my crow's feet a mort of disaster?
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we still have some time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has been slammed by a group of 34 Democratic senators for making cuts to civil rights enforcement. Senator Pat Murray led the chastise, which criticized the rollback of the staff positions who serve to investigate and protect minority students in state schools. 46 full-time civil rights investigators would lose their position because of the cuts. The investigators look into, just so you understand what they do, these investigators look into complaints lodged by students, parents, and teachers surrounding issues of discrimination based on sex, sexuality, gender, race, disability, and age. The senators who signed the letter said that they were alarmed and extremely disappointed by the cuts. The letter said this, quote, "Your testimony in front of Congress, your continued association with groups with records of supporting discrimination, and two memos written by the Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights have re-emphasized long-standing concerns about your dedication to the idea that all students, no matter their race, religion, disability, country of origin, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity, have a right to receive an education free from discrimination. You claim to support civil rights and oppose discrimination, but your actions belie your assurances." So again, that's the Department of Education under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who has cut a ton of investigators. So a lot of complaints will go unheard. They certainly will not be heard in a timely manner. This is a big deal and not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. More not good things, to say the least. A 17-year-old trans woman has been shot dead in Georgia, becoming the 14th trans person killed in the U.S. since the turn of the year. Ava Lorraine Barron was killed following an alleged altercation in the car park of Riverview Apartments, which is a building on the edge of Athens, Georgia. Athens-Clark police spokesman Epifanio Rodriguez told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that 21-year-old Jalen Breon Brown took out a gun and shot Barron. Police responding to the incident found Barron at the scene not breathing, having sustained a single gunshot wound to the side of the chest. It is a heartbreaking obituary, as many obituaries are. Friends of Barron remember her as, quote, "an adored and loved young soul who lost her life to a tragic act of violence that could have been avoided." So the 14th trans person killed in the U.S. since the turn of the year, a 17-year-old trans woman shot dead in Georgia. And those are just the individuals we know about. We know that many individuals are murdered and they are misgendered by local media, so we don't even find out about it. And then others who are not out about their trans status. So it's just the 14th that we know about, but the youngest here, a 17-year-old. Let's turn back to some national news. The United States Congress has passed a resolution which condemns an anti-gay purge in Chechnya. Months of reports have claimed that as many as 100 gay men have been rounded up and put in prisons in the nation. The bipartisan motion, House Resolution 351, was introduced on the 23rd of May by Representative Ileana Ross-Lehtinen. The Republican is also part of the House LGBT Equality Caucus. It calls on Russia to investigate the anti-gay purge in Chechnya and to put a stop to the violence. The resolution also asks the U.S. government to demand the release of individuals wrongly detained. Speaking after the resolution was passed, Representative Ross-Lehtinen said, quote, "We will continue to stand united with the LGBT community and shine a bright light on these atrocities, which are encouraged by the evil Putin regime in Russia, in order to help ensure that those who are responsible for these crimes are held to account for their despicable actions." Again, that is House Resolution 351. It was introduced on May 23rd, and it is an attempt by the United States Congress to condemn the anti-gay purge that is happening in Chechnya. Turning our attention to the state of Connecticut, Yale University is suing Connecticut over limitations on the number of gender-neutral bathrooms it can have on campus. The top university is the latest to weigh in on the debate around gender-neutral bathrooms and trans bathroom rights. The school said it is unable to carry out a plan to designate all single-stall bathrooms on campus as gender-neutral. The state building code currently does not count gender-neutral bathrooms when it assesses public buildings and their facilities. The Ivy League University said this in a lawsuit, quote, "The proposed shift in designation to gender-neutral would facilitate quick access to a bathroom within the building for persons of all gender identities. If Yale carries out its plans to introduce the gender-neutral toilets, it would need to build more restrooms designated male or female. The university argues that it is unnecessary to do so and impractical given the age of the buildings. The lawsuit asks for a court order for Yale University to carry out its plan to introduce the gender-neutral bathrooms. So still so much more work to do on the bathroom front. Some encouraging news. A new study has found that evangelical support for marriage inclusivity and acceptance of LGBT people is slowly rising. The study carried out by the Pew Research Center found that two-thirds of Americans are now in favor of equal marriage laws. The research found that the support for marriage equality across different religious groups varies, but are all slowly showing an increase. This is great news. 67% of Catholics and 68% of mainstream Protestants back same-sex marriage equality. However, the majority of white evangelical Protestants still oppose the movement, with 59% being against legislation. Despite the majority still opposing same-sex marriage, the acceptance rate has grown 21%. 21% in only the last 10 years. That is a colossal, colossal number, growing 21% in the last 10 years. Started out at 14% acceptance rate. It is up to 35% now. I know we would love for that to be over 50. Heck, I know we would love for that to be 100. But growing 21% in only 10 years, the cultural shift is real. It is real even among evangelical people in this country. And when we look at the generational differences, there's a stark contrast there. The acceptance rate among younger evangelicals is much higher. So it's 35% among all evangelicals. It's 47% of those born after 1964 who support it. That number, that 47% of young evangelical folks supporting marriage equality, that's up 29%. 29%. That is a colossal number. And again, for the flip side of the generational aspect, older religious people born between 1928 and 1964 have not shown a massive increase in acceptance. They have only risen 1%. So again, whereas with younger people, it has risen 29%. With older people, it has risen 1%. Only 1%. But that's okay. And A lot of people credit people coming out. When you come out, it's much more difficult for your older family members to say to you, we don't support you. Of course, that still happens. Of course, that still happens. But it's much more difficult to say that. And then finally, two cases from the U.S. Supreme Court. First, the good news. The Supreme Court has protected the rights of same-sex parents to be named on their children's birth certificates. The court struck down an Arkansas law that treated same-sex couples differently to opposite-sex couples on their children's birth certificates. This now landmark ruling means gay couples, my friends, can now be named on these certificates like heterosexual parents. The decision was unsigned. Neil Gorsuch, the new Supreme Court justice, he dissented. He was joined by Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito Jr. The decision overrides the U.S. state of Arkansas ruling that birth certificates will only contain the names of the child's biological parents. The plaintiffs told the Supreme Court that Arkansas's approach has serious consequences. The lawyers wrote this quote, "A child's birth certificate affects parental decision-making authority in the medical and educational context. For example, some Arkansas public schools allow only those parents named on the child's birth certificate to receive educational information absent a court order." Now, the other side of the case said that the presumption for fathers was justified because, quote, "In the overwhelming majority of cases, the mother's husband is a marital child's biological father," adding that parental rights flow from biology, not marriage. Well, the Supreme Court has rejected that, but all eyes are on Neil Gorsuch. This was his first test to see how he would side with the LGBTQ community. He did not side with the LGBTQ community. That worries us because that brings us to our second U.S. Supreme Court news. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to take up a case against a Christian baker which refused to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. Earlier this year, the highest court in the U.S. put off taking up the case, having held over the decision 12 previous times. But despite speculation that the court would not take up the case, it is agreed to hear it next term. This is greatly, greatly concerning because I don't know that the votes are with us on this one. And again, Neil Gorsuch is going to be a big piece of this. A big piece of this. And there's a lot of concern right now that Justice Kennedy is going to step down. And if Justice Kennedy steps down and President Trump is able to appoint another Supreme Court justice, aside from the fact that his legacy will likely be cemented, two Supreme Court justices being appointed under one term, that's a lot for a president. It will kind of, you know, spell disaster for the LGBTQ community. We will not have the Supreme Court votes for any future cases unless the law is super clear and on our side. And even so, the conservative interpretation of the law is not going to help us out. So we must pay close attention to what is happening on the Supreme Court level. We have to decry injustice wherever and whenever we see it. If you have the means to do so, pursue legal action. If you are the victim of some sort of discrimination, and you can always contact Lambda Legal, just go to lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org, and you can connect with some resources there. That, my friends, is it for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. I'm actually leaving this weekend to head to Guatemala for the next 2 weeks, so we will have some incredible rainbow rewinds for you of some of my favorite shows lately. As always, drop me a line, ken@thisshowissogay.com. I love hearing from you all. So just drop me an email. Every single email gets answered. Our huge thanks to Kirsten Palladino. Go pick up her book, Equally Wed. And to Michael Corey, you will be able to pick up the soundtrack to War Paint. It is incredible. He puts incredible lyrics out there. You guys, you go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to raise up the voices of your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, to support all of our allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?